from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. In the past 10 years, Elena Ferrante's quartet of books, the Neapolitan novel, so captivated readers that many swarmed Naples, Italy, searching for mentioned sites. Colson Whitehead's The Underground Railroad sparked deep conversations on slavery nationwide. Some books of the past decade will stick with us for years, and others will drift out of our memories. As we enter the final days of the decade, we reflect on the best and most beloved books. Tell us, what is your favorite book of the 2010s? That's all next, after the news. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Paul Beatty's The Sellout, Donna Tartt's Goldfinch, George Saunders' 10th of December, those are just a few of the books that readers have gushed over this decade. In this hour, we want to hear about the book from the past decade that you still insist your friends read, the one book that you're sure will follow you into coming decades. And we're talking about the best and most beloved books of the 2010s and want to hear your pick. You can give us a call right now at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. That number again, 866-733-6786. And, of course, you can also get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum. Or email any questions or comments or your picks to forum@kqed.org or post them at kqed.org/forum. Joining us in the studio for this hour is Oscar Villalon, managing editor of Zizova, the San Francisco-based literary journal. Good morning, Oscar.
Good morning.
Also say good morning to Barbara Lane, who's also with us here, book columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle and director of events at Copperfield Books. Good morning, Barbara.
Hi, Michael.
Delighted to have you both here. And this is a difficult thing to do. I mean, it's like people picking the Oscars. Mm-hmm. You know, what do you look for mm-hmm. when you think of best books of the decade? Even making a list of 10 and then trying to cull them and say what should be first or what should be second and so forth. I mean, I find it agonizing. Well, maybe that's too strong a word, but I certainly find it challenging. What about you two? Thoughts about criteria? Or touchstones to that first.
Well, Michael, I look for books that really resonate with me and books that are going to have a lasting resonance beyond a week, 2 weeks. And this was difficult, frankly, because my memory is not getting any better. So a lot of the books I love the most are the books I've read most recently. But I did go back and come up with some books that I know will stay on my bookshelf and that I'll be lending to people forever because they meant so much to me. Do you want me to start in?
Sure. Why not?
Okay.
We'll hear from listeners and Oscar. And
yes.
Go ahead.
I'm going to start with Elena Ferrante. Elena Ferrante.
All four?
Well, the quartet is pretty astounding. As most people know, it's a coming-of-age story about a friendship between two girls in 1950s Naples. And it shows us an aspect of Italian lower-class society that has rarely been depicted this way. It shows us a friendship. It shows us what it means to be a girl and a woman. And it takes us through just sort of an extraordinary chronicle of life. Is every book as good as every other? Not necessarily. Probably My Brilliant Friend, the first one, to my mind, is the best.
That was a movie, too.
HBO adapted it. Yeah. And when I was looking for some commentary on it last night, almost all of the things that I could find online were about the HBO adaptation, which I did not watch, sadly.
I saw it.
But did you love it?
I thought it was good. I wouldn't say I loved it, but I thought it was good.
I heard it was snail-paced, which sometimes
it was slow, yeah.
Yeah. But I will say I think she did something extraordinary, not only in composing this portrait of a society, but also, there's all the mystery around Elena Ferrante and who is she. So that just adds spice to all of it.
And people are going in droves to Naples and trying to hunt down all of the things that are in the quartet or things that they find of interest in the quartet.
Exactly.
Oscar, what about you?
Well,
this is a hard process, isn't it?
It's extremely hard, but I think what Barbara was saying is true. I think when you put together these lists as a critic, perhaps you're looking for different things. You're looking for things of, in terms of craft, structure of the book.
Style.
Style, but also, too, just the voice and the particular vision of a writer and whether it's new or what it adds to our current, discourse. But I think for the reader, the non-critic, and by non-critic, I mean we're all critics, just the people who don't get paid for criticism. It's what resonates, and for whatever reason,
never got paid for any of mine, by the way.
Well, you know, we barely get paid, by the way. It's what resonates, what sticks with you, and different things stick with you because of your background, because of your experiences, because of where you're at your particular time in life. I'm sure things that you would love at 25, you may not feel as strongly about when you're 50, you know, these sort of things. So, but for me, and oddly enough, the one that does stick out, and this is for those who know me, they may start laughing as soon as I say this because I'm such a hunk about his work. And I was very, I guess, surprised to learn it came out in 2012 because I thought maybe it'd come out earlier, but I guess I was wrong. It was the fourth volume of Robert Caro's Lyndon Johnson biography, the Passage to Power.
Mm-hmm. It's biography about as good as it can get.
As good as it gets. But and the writing is absolutely superb.
Can I push you toward fiction, though?
With fiction, you know, there's a ton, but I will say two. Paul Beatty's The Sellout. A long time admirer of Paul Beatty's fiction. You know, his first book, The White Boy Shuffle, was just amazing. The Sellout, not only one of the best books ever written about Los Angeles, but I think one of the better books that have been written about our psyche and just how we try to process the sort of insanity of the American condition. The other one, and I think this is kind of like to play off of the Ferrante, the Rachel Kusk, her trio of novels, Outline, Transit, and Kudos. Those are three exquisite novels.
I've not read a word of hers. Tell me why I should.
Well, let me tell you why I kind of came late to it. So basically, it's a book about a writer's life, and that on its face, especially for people involved in the literary community, may be a little off-putting because I just don't want to know any more about that, to be perfectly honest. And the first book, on its face, may not seem promising. It's about a writer going to a conference in Greece. But that's like saying, again, you know, like that Moby Dick is about a guy trying to kill a whale. They are structured in such a way in which I would describe it as these people who normally would be tangential to the person's life get the spotlight. Various people she meets, people we would normally, let's say, in other novels would just be secondary characters. And for lack of a better word, the way I would describe it, she allows them to have their aria. She allows them to have a spotlight. And we delve into their world in these wonderful – I mean, the thing that might remind you the most of is the way Philip Roth – can talk through scenes and the way suddenly we just fall into this sort of rabbit hole of discourse and getting more and more into a person's life. And how did that happen? Was just a conversation on an airplane. Now suddenly this thing becomes like a mini epic, but they're absolutely stunning.
Can I jump in and respond to something Oscar said about reading a book when you're 25 and then reading it again when you're 50?
It's a totally
or
different
even
book.
Afterwards, I've experienced that recently with two books, one of which is Madame Bovary, which I read at the appropriately young age, and then later again with my book club. And it was just absolutely a different book. My sympathies...
It was not a masterpiece when you were young, right?
Well, not so much. And I had so much sympathy for Emma Bovary then, and I just had... Not so much when I read it the second time. The other book that happened for me was Virginia Woolf's Mrs. Dalloway. When I first read it, it was just like, who cares about this woman? And she's walking across London. And then reading it at this age, the inner life of a woman that age and all the rumination and all the regret and sadness and... It was just a gorgeous, gorgeous book. So I highly, highly recommend rereading. I think it's a wonderful thing.
Well, that indeed is an important recommendation. We're going to hear some recommendations from our listeners, beginning, Rachel, with you. Hi, you're on.
Hi, I'm calling to recommend The Island of a Thousand Mirrors by Naomi Munawera. Mm-hmm. It's from Sri Lanka, the book. And what's amazing to me is I lived in Sri Lanka during the 80s, during the Civil War. And when I read this book, she took me back in sound and in smell. It's almost like I was in Sri Lanka again, and she did it with such kindness. And I don't know that I've read a book about a war that is so loving.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
It's amazing how when your senses are hit that way, especially senses that are familiar to you, it can have an extraordinary impact on you as a reader. And thank you for that, Rachel. Good to hear from you. Let me hear from another listener. Jim, join us. You're on. Jim, are you there?
Is it Jim or Tim?
I see Jim, but you can be Tim if you like.
Okay. I'm just calling from Los Altos, and a couple of social science books that just turned my head around. One was The Blind Spot. It's a small book, but it does a beautiful job of explaining some of the inscrutable ways that we don't understand why we do what we do as a society. And in different cohorts and with privilege and implicit associations. The Blind Spot just turned my head around. Also, The Righteous Mind by John Haidt was also a real eye-opener. So I recommend both of those for anybody who's wondering why we as a society behave the way we do and we're not aware of it.
Jim, I thank you for those recommendations. We were thinking about, should we do all fiction? Should we talk about fiction and nonfiction? Mm. I keep coming back in my mind, you know, naturally, I suppose, to the writers we featured on the forum program, some of them which made a lot of these lists of best novels of the decade. But those are, in a way, tougher choices than the nonfiction, at least for me. I mean, I thought of Harari's books, which had a great deal of effect on me, Yuval Harari. And as far as nonfiction, I also thought about Jill Lepore's book,
oh, yeah.
Which
oh, yeah.
kind of revolutionizes your thoughts about American history in
right.
ways that I hadn't experienced in many years. But we always get great recommendations from our listeners, and we're going to keep them online for those of you who want to access them. They'll be part of our website, and let's hear from some more. Let's hear from Peter next. Peter, join us.
Yes, I recommend. It's a nonfiction, and it is A Lawrence in Arabia, written by Scott Anderson, I believe, a few years ago. And I find it a remarkable book because it's a different perspective into the Arab revolt against the Ottomans in 1916-1917. And a really defining moment with the division, really, of the Ottomans up into the present day and the betrayal of the Arabs by the Sykes-Picot Agreement. And it's from four different perspectives. Lawrence, the English representative, an American individual, Yale, an Austrian, and a Jew living in Palestine at that time behind the lines. And how it tells a remarkable story, too, things that I certainly didn't know about, that the really defining moment is one of those extraordinary historical moments that turns on just one incident. And this is the incident when Lawrence himself was away on an expedition for 2 months at the same time that Sykes, the major, who's a scoundrel and a confidence man who persuaded the British, he himself was British, to the British to actually agree to a division of Arabia, and in fact and to convince the King Hussein, leader of the Arab revolt, to go along with it, and the betrayal that took place later, and the division, as I said, of Arabia into its present.
That's a pretty full review, Peter. obviously, the book had a great deal of impact on you, and thank you for that recommendation. Good to hear from you. I'm wondering about these lists that have come out. You know, a lot of writers, think about Colson Whitehead, for example, mm-hmm. or for that matter, Zadie Smith, who have more than one book over the decade. And that makes it difficult, too, in some ways, doesn't it, Barbara?
Yes, it does for me. And actually, my list is almost entirely fiction, which is characteristic of me. But I do have one nonfiction book that's related to a fiction book that ties into what you just said. So my friend Stephen out at Point Reyes Books, who has a bookstore that's has a lot of environmental books for obvious reasons because it's in that part of the world, says one of the bestsellers in his store, and a book I absolutely adored, was Peter Wolenben's The Hidden Life of Trees, mm-hmm. which is about how trees actually talk to each other. That tie, it's a marvelous book. That ties directly into Richard Powers, who wrote a book called The Overstory. Richard Powers, many people came to know him through his early work, which was largely sci-fi stuff. Not my thing. Not my thing at all. But then he started writing these novels, one of which was The Time of Our Singing, another of which, The Echo Maker, about a migration of cranes in, I believe it was South Dakota, got better and better. And then this book, The Overstory, that came out either last year or the year before, about a group of eco-activists and how they try to save a grove of trees, blew my mind. I mean, the characters, the human nature of it, the whole sort of global climate issue that he puts it front and center without being didactic, telling a really human story, was one of my favorite books of the year. So Richard Powers is somebody who has a body of work that I believe culminated in The Overstory, and that's definitely on my list.
Well, there are many more to add to this list, obviously, and we're going to talk to Jennifer Egan, who is not only number one for Visit from the Goon Squad, according to Literary Hub, but number one in Time magazine also. And they picked her. This gets back to criteria, again, that we talked about initially. Time magazine said they want a page-turner, and they're talking about novels, of course, and something that gives a fresh perspective and a different view of the world. And those are kind of reasonable criteria, I think. Ryan tweets, Simon versus the Homo Sapiens Agenda by Becky Albertalli was my first time seeing my high school queer experience depicted, and it was so much fun to read. Which brings up another question. You know, the canon is always changing, fortunately, long overdue to be changing. By the canon, I mean those recognized works that are celebrated and given primary influence, especially in the United States. But I noticed that what we're seeing, and I just want to make this remark, and then we're going to get Jenny Egan on with us. There's a lot more people of color, a lot more women. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really refreshing, and it's welcome, and I may say so, editorial comment, overdue, long overdue. But Jennifer Egan is the author and winner of the Pulitzer Prize for fiction for A Visit from the Goon Squad, and her new book is called Manhattan Beach. And good to have you back with us on Forum.
Thank you so much.
Well, delighted to have you back with us. She's a home gal, too, in fact, grew up in San Francisco and has been on the program a number of times, I'm pleased to say. What does it feel like, though? Congratulations. I mean, to have Goon Squad picked as the best work of fiction of the decade? Can you give us a little bit of what your inner life is experiencing with this?
You know, I mean, I just a tremendous sense of good luck to have remained in the conversation, which is something that, you know, one has absolutely no control over. And the truth is, I mean, there's such a paradox to any of these designations, and I include awards in that, which is that they take on this sort of iconic quality once a decision like that has been reached. But the truth is they're rather arbitrary and subjective choices made by groups of people. So they really are just good luck. And I think it's so important to remember that, especially because it feels terrible not to be on those lists. And I know that feeling too. So I feel lucky once again to still be in the conversation with Goon Squad, and I'm very grateful.
Well, you're bringing luck into it. Just shows your humility. And I also want to bring up the fact that you did another book, Manhattan Beach, as we said, after Goon Squad, and you're still writing. I mean, you're writing a novel now. How does this? What kind of impact does it have to be selected for something like this, as opposed to, say, the Pulitzer Prize, on your writing?
I mean, you know, I feel especially happy to have Goon Squad honored, actually, because the book I'm working on now is really sort of a companion to it. I mean, I'm following characters from that book into other realms. So I guess it's especially welcome because it's nice to feel that people are still interested, or some people are still interested in that world that I was exploring. You know, in a certain way, I feel like it doesn't really matter which book it is. It's just nice to feel like people are still interested. I mean, that's such a luxury. There's so many books out there, and who knows why some end up getting this attention and some don't. It's just you know, it's nice to have that validation when I'm still exploring that sphere.
Not all luck, though, if I may say. And by the way, I think there were many who wanted to find out what happened to those characters and wanted to follow their lives more. I kind of thought you might go back to them. But tell us a little bit about what you look for when you think about, well, a great novel. I know you and your mother, who is a good friend of mine, are great readers of Thackeray and, you know, have sort of taken on various kinds of classics, shall we say, in a quite a serious and profound way. But given that perspective and given your own perspective as a writer, what makes for a great novel?
You know, I mean, I think some of it is obviously just chemistry. So what seems to activate my personal chemistry toward that judgment is a combination of things. I think for sure I need to have a deep emotional engagement. I think that really is actually the most important. Just a sense of really caring about what happens to these people. And then I think what is also really important for me is a sense of freshness, something that I haven't actually read this story before. You know, there's a certain satisfaction in seeing a formula beautifully fulfilled, and that accounts for all kinds of different, you know, art forms in various realms. But that is not what I'm looking for. I like that feeling of discovery, both as a reader and a writer. And I think for me, too, another aspect of that feeling of discovery is a sense of a strong intellectual girding, a sense of an awareness of ideas, a curiosity about ideas. And I think as part of that, a really gritty and profound engagement with the culture around us. Even if it's, you know, with Manhattan Beach, I was writing a historical novel, so it was set in another era. But, you know, but as with, you know, most historical novels, the questions I was asking were very informed by our era. So those are things I try to do as a writer because I want them so badly as a reader.
Well, you're starting to break up a little because you're up in the coldness of Minnesota. It may have something to do with it, but it's really good to have you with us. Always pleased to have you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Jennifer Egan, author and winner of the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction for A Visit from the Goon Squad, which has made a lot of the best of the decade lists so far. And we should mention we're coming up on a break here, but almost predictably, George Saunders, Junot Diaz, I mean, the names that keep coming, Sadie Smith, that keep coming up on this list of the best of the decade are the names that, well, writers have gotten a lot of attention and not necessarily all luck in many instances. We're talking about craft. We're talking about stories that engage readers. And we're talking with Barbara Lane and Oscar Villalone and you, our listeners. Quick summoning forward recommendations from a tweet from Catherine. It says, Drift, The Unmooring of American Military Power by Rachel Maddow is one of the best nonfiction books of the past decade. Really showcases Maddow's expert storytelling skills. Joe writes, he mentions Nausgaard's masterpiece, My Struggle, a unique autobiographical work, and that's putting it mildly. And here's a listener who says, The Man Who Invented Fiction, How Cervantes Ushered in the Modern World by William Eggington. Another listener says, California Coast Traffic, A Horseback Adventure from Mexico to Oregon in 1911 by Smeaton Chase. We'll hear more of your picks when we return. Stay tuned. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the best books of the decade with Oscar Villalone, managing editor of Zizova, the San Francisco-based literary journal. And I should mention that Zizova has just published its Bay Area issue and celebrates its 35th anniversary next year. Congratulations, Oscar.
No, thank you.
Barbara Lane, also with us in studio, book columnist with the San Francisco Chronicle and director of events for Copperfield Books. And you can be part of this program if you have a book that you really think stands out and a book that you feel others should read. Share the wealth with us and let us know what that book is or who that author is. You can do that by joining us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Number again, 866-733-6786. A listener writes, In Extremis, The Life and Death of War Correspondent Marie Colvin by Lindsay Hilsium is an excellent read. She brings to life her friend as a gutsy, fast-living person of our time and was compelled to tell human stories behind the headlines of war. Let me go to more of your calls. And let's go to Chris in Oakland. Chris, join us.
Oh, my God. Hi, this is Chris in Oakland. And my heart is pounding right now, both for being on your show and because of this book that I'm an incredibly avid reader. I can't even count the number of books I read in a month. And when I heard your show and said the one book, this I had to call. This is a book called A Little Life, and it's a story written by Hanya Yanagihara, a woman from college onward. It's a book that ICE have stopped recommending to people because people love it so much but are so tortured by it, or they are so tortured by it they hate me for recommending it. It is a deeply powerful, emotional story of the gay struggle and being the mother of a gay son. This it moved me tremendously. It is tremendously powerful writing from a female about male friendships. It's a story, I've seen it called, tragedy porn, but it's also a story about such horror and such love and such hope. It's the most moving thing I've ever read in my life. And, again, but I'll recommend it on your show, but I don't recommend it to people anymore. People have called me up crying and said, why did you tell me about that book? Or people will call me up and say, I need to take a walk with you right now. Or my own husband, after he read it, said, why did you tell me about that book? Didn't you know that it would raise XYZ for me? And he literally stopped talking to me for a week.
Well, Chris, you've raised, an important point here, and that is a lot of people will say, I don't want to read a book that's going to depress me. I mean, I looked on the list of the – and Chris, thank you for that – list of best books of the decade, and I saw Cormac McCarthy, The Road. I mean, a writer who I admire enormously, but that book is such a downer. You know, there's no way around it. Oscar, some thoughts from you on this?
Well, yeah. I mean, this is why you always preface these things by saying the book is harrowing, but I think it's worth it because of X. Usually there has to be some sort of payoff to it, that you go through that discomfort, for lack of a better word, this very challenging experience.
Your eyes can be open
experience.
And you can learn so much from that discomfort, too.
You absolutely can.
Great art is often terribly discomforting.
Yeah. I found those books much easier to read when I was younger.
When you become a parent, certain things become a lot harder to read.
Yeah.
But I often think about that because some of the most powerful works of literature, certainly cinematically too, are things that are painful, are things that are difficult, are things that have explicit violence in them. I'm thinking now of somebody who's on my list I know is very controversial. My book club took umbrage with this, but I thought Oscar Wong's On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous was
Ocean Wong.
Yeah. Say what?
Ocean Wong?
Ocean Wong.
Yeah.
I said Oscar because I was thinking of you. Ocean Wong, On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous, was a beautiful book. This is by a young Vietnamese man talking about his family's experience in this country and his own coming of age as a gay man. And there's horrific, painful violence in it. And some people are just turned off by it. It's not what they want to do when they go home at night, is read something that excites all of that kind of emotion. But for me, when a book can really affect you this way, as the last caller indicated, I mean, profoundly, that author has done something magical. That author has managed to touch you in a way that's quite rare and beautiful. So I celebrate that.
You mentioned Vietnamese authors. Have either of you read The Sympathizer?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. We featured that author on. And that book has made a number of these lists, I think deservedly so. As I said, we've seen an international picture just brightening and expanding here of writers who are celebrated, and that's all to the good. We'll go to some more calls and find out what you want to recommend. Kenny, go ahead. You're on.
Okay. Among Swimming, Malachi McCourt, and I bought this for a Christmas present, and I noticed it said 2009, so I guess, or 1998, I'm sorry. So I guess,
Kenny, you hit a nostalgic chord with me. The McCords, we used to feature them on Forum going way back.
I would love to hear that. This guy really, he's an Irish guy, and the best just knows how to tell the tale. Really, really special. Among Swimming. Anything that he writes, I'd like to check out.
All right.
And the other one was 2010, so I got in just in time over there, is Cutting for Stone. By Abraham Verghese, and he's apparently a professor at Stanford, and
he is
a doctor there, and
an extraordinary writer too. Yeah,
Yes, I'd like to check out some of his other books, but this was a story. I'm going to read from the back, if that's okay. It's a little easier. Marion and Shiva Stone are born brothers, born of a secret union between a beautiful Indian nun and a brash British surgeon. Orphaned by their mother's death and their father's disappearance, bound together by a preternatural connection and a shared fascination with medicine, the twins come of age as Ethiopia hovers on the brink of revolution. Moving from Addis Ababa, this is only a little bit more. Moving from Addis Ababa to New York City and back again, Cutting for Stone is an unforgettable story of love and betrayal, medicine and ordinary miracles, and two brothers whose fates are forever intertwined.
Good review there, Kenny, and thank you for that. In fact, if you want to go to our archives, I think you can find an interview with Abraham Verghese. And let me repeat the titles he just mentioned, A Monk Swimming and Cutting for Stone by Abraham Verghese. And that whole idea of when you're entranced by an author, I mean, we did a whole special tribute to Toni Morrison. I haven't read God Help the Child, her latest book. Have either of you? Mm-hmm. I'm a little hesitant because I'm wondering if I'll be maybe disappointed because mm-hmm. so many of her books have rocked my world, you know. And when a writer experiments and moves into different territory, sometimes doesn't quite have, shall we say, anything near the impact that other books of theirs have. Here's Kristen, who recommends Wolf Totem by Jean Rang. Either of you know that? Beautifully written and interesting for its social commentary, environmental commentary, and historical commentary. And Ralph recommends a science fiction book, Children of Time, a novel by Adrian Tchaikovsky. We were talking about science fiction before, Barbara, kind of not your thing and all that. There still is kind of a snobbery about science fiction. There's also a snobbery about some of these books that have done gloriously well in sales. I'm thinking about a book like Gone Girl, which came up on some of these lists.
Yes, I saw that. I saw that, and there is, because if everybody likes it, how good could it be? I mean, that's the thinking. You have to have some rarefied, and that's really nonsense, you know, I have come to believe. I mean, I spent quite a few years sort of dissing Stephen King, and then I really sat down and read Stephen King and thought, he's a master plotter. I mean, the one about Lee Harvey Oswald just blew my mind away. So I think we have to just relax a little about that.
And we'll get more callers aboard. Susan, join us. Hi.
Oh, hi. I wanted to recommend Unsheltered by Barbara Kingsolver. And I'm not sure. I know it's a recent book. I know it's fairly recent. And she writes, it's a wonderful kind of a family story, but it shows the cultural conflict we have today and even its roots in the 19th century, and somehow it's both tragic and very hopeful. And the theme is all around kind of a house falling down and how everyone is feeling fairly unsheltered but close together.
Well, thank you so much for that, Susan. Good to hear from you. In fact, yeah, Oscar, you would probably know Kingsolver has an award that she gives to socially conscious fiction every year. And somebody got it this year. I'm trying to retain or summon that name because it's on some of these lists of best books of the decade. Would you know what that is?
I don't.
But Barbara, do you know what that is?
I don't.
No? Okay. But I think maybe the listener that, does.
Yeah, the social relevance, I think, is huge now. I think you can see that, too, in a lot of the books that are being selected. I mean, if you look at some of these lists, you know, not to get too far off field in terms of fiction, but you know, it's hard to not look at the past decade and immediately books that come to mind, like, you know, Ta-Nehisi Coates' Between the World and Me, a book that I thought was wonderful, Sam Quiñones' Dreamland, about the opiate epidemic, you know.
Coates did a novel, too, didn't he?
Yeah, he just did a novel that came out. But I'm saying these in the past 10 years, the ones that really – and also, I mean, we haven't talked about, but poetry. This has been an incredible decade for poetry, not the least of which, you know, Claudia Rankine's book Citizen. Mm-hmm. Which sold two things. One sold a ton, which is, you know, something for poetry, but also really energized a whole group of writers in terms of what's possible in writing about, you know, this particular American society of ours and how to do that. You know, it's and, you know, there's other poets as well too. You know, she may be in the vanguard of it, but you know, thinking locally, someone like, you know, Javier Zamora, you know, his book Unaccompanied, his poetry collection.
And we'll get more callers and more recommendations. Kazoo, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for having me. I just wanted to point out a great book. It's Emergent Strategy by Adrienne Marie Brown. I recommend it to anybody who is doing work in community work or social justice, environmental work, anyone who's really trying to be a part of the movement to sustain the planet, to sustain our societies, to kind of push back against the strong man impulse that's sweeping the nation and the country. I mean the world, rather. It's a great, it's very well written and easy to enter into. Not a lot of, you know, sometimes books can be a little more academic and off-putting when you're trying to get into thinking about social structures. And this one is really beautifully written and like a pleasure to read.
Well, thank you for that. Good to hear from you and appreciate the call. And Kimberly writes, I hate to be the fly in the ointment, but I think Richard Powers' the overstory is overrated. We'll get maybe some tension here. I love parts of it, but I felt all the characters spoke with one voice. A better choice for me was Peter Wollenben's The Secret Life of Trees, what they feel, how they communicate, discoveries from a secret world. It's already been recommended by somebody else, and let's get another caller on with another recommendation. Genevieve, good morning. Excuse me. I'm sorry. Yeah.
That's okay. It's Genevieve. I'm Polish.
Okay.
So my recommendation is 21 Lessons for the 21st Century, and I hope I'm pronouncing his name right, Yuval Noah Harari.
Yeah, he was featured on Forum, and the interview is in our archives, and I already recommend a couple of other books of his, but that's the most recent. What did you love about it? What do you want to recommend it for? Why do you want to recommend it?
I recommend it because it's just amazing to me that it's so extremely readable about, you know, just a ton of very difficult current topics. And there are things that everybody should be thinking about now, and it gives you some perspectives to work with. And it's, I like the way he lays out all these little plots, so he actually gives you a little scenario to think about sometimes. And he's not didactic, and he doesn't oppress you with a ton of esoteric vocabulary.
Well, thank you for that. He could have done that, but he writes very clearly, and he's English is his second language. He's Israeli. He's also gay, and he's also someone who is a leading historian. Have either of you read Harari?
I read about him.
Boy, yeah. he is he's the real deal. I mean, for me, he's one of those writers that just stands out because he takes on technology and he takes on currents and even does yoga and stuff. I mean, just
even
amazing
yoga.
Pastiche of things that you wouldn't necessarily expect from a historian. Jackie writes, our own Tommy Orange is there is going to be read for generations and will influence our future writers. And we all agree.
Can I jump in, Michael? I just had the amazing pleasure of seeing Tommy Orange with Pam Houston, who was one of his teachers in Santa Fe at the Institute of American Indian, I don't have the name correct, but which brings up Native writers. And they read together at a conference, and it was just thrilling to see the two of them. And I love that book. But I just have to...
Have you read her stuff about cowboys?
Yes.
I love that stuff.
Yeah, she's a wonderful writer. You know, for me, the big issue we're dealing with now that has started to become reflected in fiction in a really interesting way is immigration. It's my issue. It's the issue everybody, I think, should be very focused on because of what's happening in this country. So I've been reading a lot of books from other parts of the world that deal with the immigration experience, from Mohsin Hamid's Exit West. He's a British Pakistani, and he writes about civil war in an unnamed city and the psychology of displacement. I thought that was a wonderful, wonderful book. He wrote The Reluctant Fundamentalist also. But Nigerian writer Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie.
See, Americana book.
Americana.
That's an extraordinary book.
Yeah. It's an extraordinary book. And before that, Half of a Yellow Sun. I mean, again, she's giving us an experience that in our myopic American society, we need to have. Because as we become more global, these things are important. And finally, there's one last one. Let's see. Well, I'm just going to, this is, I'm cheating, Michael, but I have to. The best book I read on immigration this year, and my favorite book I read this year, sadly, isn't going to be published to January, but I'm just putting everyone on notice that Janine Cummins' book, which is called American Dirt, is such an unbelievable immigration story about a mother and her son who are escaping a Mexican drug cartel and ride La Bestia, the train, north. Mm-hmm. Please, please, if you buy no other book in January, buy American Dirt.
Well, since you mentioned books in January and immigration, I'll plug my friend Isabel Allende's book, which could be coming out in January.
Yes.
Takes place initially in Spain during the revolution.
Speaking of the Bestia, one of the books I had.
Excuse me. I was just going to say, add to that. But you get all of this detail about migrants trying to escape from Spain when the fascists came into power, mm-hmm. and some of them escaped to Chile. So the book goes from Franco to Pinochet. But it's also a book that really displays what it's like in a very vivid way to be in these migrant camps. It's very relevant to the present. I'm sorry, Oscar.
Well, I was going to say, if you want to know more about the Bestia, the Beast, Oscar Martinez's book, nonfiction work about that, where he follows the children, coming in through Central America and riding that godforsaken train all the way through, southern Mexico, all the way to the border. We talk about, the caller was talking about earlier about books that don't make you break you and make you mm-hmm. cry. Martinez's work is one of them. I mean, along those lines, we mentioned earlier Javier Zamora's a poetry collection, Accompanied. That's exactly what that's about, having to, immigrate, by himself as a child, to the United States from El Salvador. About the immigrant experience, one of them that's also was very good that came out of this decade that I particularly liked was Leslie Tenorio's story collection, Monstrous, all set in the Filipino-American community. Lovely book published by Echo. Highly, highly recommend.
I will highly recommend another book, an author who I was very fond of personally, Ernest Gaines, who died this year, an mm-hmm. African-American author. Book Bloodline that he did a number of years ago, and he had connection to San Francisco. In fact, he got a master's degree in creative writing at San Francisco State. Big loss. Went down to the Bayou country and really covered mm-hmm. black life down in Louisiana. Let me get some more callers on her, but before I do, Sean writes, Ready Player One by Ernest Cline really hit me. I felt it was one of the catalysts for the revival of the 80s nostalgia in recent years. The movie diminished my love for it, but I look forward to reading it again soon. And here's Judy. Judy, join us.
Hi. It was just mentioned, but There by Tommy Orange, about the contemporary experience of the urban Native American in Oakland. And I was just so woken by this book because it's such a forgotten experience. And I was so grateful to be reading the content. Also, Exit West was mentioned.
Yes.
That is like the most beautiful love story. As a Middle Eastern woman myself, I really appreciated that book. And lastly, Jasmine Ward, mm-hmm. Salvage the Bones, Sing, Unburied, Sing, writing about the experience in the Deep South and having lived there and cared for people there. I was just incredibly moved by the way that she portrays the experience that felt so very true. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Judy. For those, as long as we're talking about Native American writers, can we put a plug in for Sherman Alexie and for Louise Erdrich and also mm-hmm. particularly for Leslie Marmon Silko, whose book mm-hmm. Celebration is really a book that has been in prominence and kind of passed now, as so many of these books do, but still should be in prominence.
What's exciting in the Native American realm is, like Tommy Orange, there's so many new writers.
Excuse me, did I say celebrate? I meant ceremony.
Ceremony. Ceremony. Leslie Merman. Yeah. There's so many new writers coming out, particularly of this program in Santa Fe, and one of them is Therese Milo, whose mm-hmm. book is Heartberries. Really great stuff, and we are seeing a whole other side of the Native American experience, and it's welcome.
Yeah. Also, again, to some poetry, Leila Lally Strong, her collection. Also, Natalie Diaz, When My Brother Was an Aztec.
Yeah, we'll stick with the decade, though. Here's Judd, who says, I'm counting Lou Sixkin's trilogy is one book, The Three-Body Problem, The Dark Forest, and Death's End. The trilogy starts during the Chinese Cultural Revolution and ends millions of light years into the future in a parallel universe. So there's more science fiction, and here's more callers. Petra, join us.
Hi, good morning, and thanks for having me.
Good morning.
I'm very excited to recommend to you The Soul and the Seed. It's a series of, the first of the series of six by Ari Farnam, F-A-R-N-A-M. She's an absolutely obscure writer that I have incidentally met years ago in Czech Republic. She was raised in Oregon and is legally blind and writes amazing books over in Czech Republic that she self-publishes, which she really shouldn't. She needs a huge publishing house because she's the most talented writer I've ever read. She asked me years ago to proofread this book, The Soul and the Seed, and I was on bed rest for 4 months. So I was like, okay, I have nothing else to do. I'll read it. And I dove into it and I read the whole series, and it was one of the most amazing books I've ever read. It was so well crafted and the story made so much sense, and it's actually a dystopian fantasy thriller, which all three words turned me off.
Well, your enthusiasm is noted and is infectious. Thank you for that, Petra. In fact, talk about dystopians. I was surprised not to see Margaret Atwood's Handmaid's Tale on any of these lists because it won a Booker. I mean, the new one won a Booker, yeah. I don't know what to make of that. But again, like Oscar says, it's so subjective when we talk about this. Let's hear what some other listeners have to say. Let me thank Petra for her call and go right to Elizabeth in Woodland. Morning.
Good morning. I read mostly biographies, and I heard about this book, American Eden. It was written up in the New York Times. It was written by Victoria Johnson. It's about David Hossack, botany and medicine in the garden of the early republic. He was the doctor who dealt with, took care of Alexander Hamilton after the duel. But he was a botanist and created the first botanic garden in the U.S., taught classes in how to use plants for botany. His original garden is now the Rockefeller Center. There is a plaque where his garden was. And also part of it was at the Vanderbilt House, which is mostly gone too. But the book, nearly 500 pages. I read it almost in one sitting. You cannot put it down.
Well, that's a lot to read in one sitting. Yeah. Elizabeth.
Well, it's relating all the presidents and all the people. I mean, you know, Franklin, everybody, and plants and medicine. I mean, it was just fascinating.
Yeah, it sounds like a potent mix, and thank you for that recommendation. That's, again, American Eden, and we'll go right to another recommender. Morgan, that's you. Hi. Morgan, are you there? Well, we'll try one more time, and we'll say goodbye because nobody's answered. She didn't answer. Is Phil with us? Phil, go ahead.
Hello?
Yeah, hi, Phil.
I want to recommend Robert Caro's The Passage of Power. His quartet, The Path to Power, Means of Ascent, and The Master of the Senate, show liberals that Lyndon Johnson hated the press. He had mistresses in the White House and in the hill country of Texas. He lied all the time. He had to win. He was very similar to Trump. He treated his staff like slaves, and yet we idealize him. Caro wrote these books not just because he wanted to portray Johnson, but he wanted to portray our entire political system.
Excuse me, Phil. Do we still idolize Johnson? I'm not sure, especially after Vietnam, that we really idolize Johnson. I mean, he's done more domestically, one could argue, than any other president, but that may be overstated. But the Caro, again, can't say enough things about Caro that are complimentary and plaudits. I think we have Morgan back. Morgan, you weren't even with us, but now you are. Welcome. Well, maybe you're not. The disappearing Morgan. One more time. Morgan, are you there? Something with that phone, maybe. Here's a recommendation from Rita I'm going to read. I must recommend The Goldfinch by Donna Tartt. Truly, I don't think there was anything else in the decade that had the impact on me that one had. She used the prologue to set up the main character as someone who has killed, then drops us back into the painful and confusing childhood. From there, She gives us character and character who reflect this dichotomy of good and bad from beginning to end, never allowing us to rest in one view. You know, I never did read that novel, but I heard a lot of people complaining about the ending. Any comments from either of you? Did you like the novel?
I liked the novel a lot. I thought it was, you know, Donna Tartt writes a book like every 15 years. Mm-hmm. She spends a lot of time. And I thought it was very successful. And there's some imagery from that book that really stuck with me. Absolutely. I liked it.
Want to weigh in on this, Oscar?
No, I'll pass on Goldfinch.
All right. We've got seconds left. Any other recommended must-reads from either of you?
Quiet, kind of quiet one, but I know a lot of people who read it really loved it. Paulette Giles' News of the World, wonderful book in which a Civil War veteran accompanies a young orphan girl across Texas, and it's poetic and suspenseful and funny and touching. I liked it very, very much.
One from you before we conclude, Oscar?
It only came out a couple of years ago, but I think people should check out Octavio Solis' Retablos, his collection from City Lights Books.
I remember talking about that with you on the air a few years ago when it came out, and you were celebrating
collection.
It then. Yes. Well, thank you both so much for being with us, and thanks to Jennifer Egan for being with us this hour as well, and thanks to you, our listeners, for all the recommendations you've provided. They will be at our website, kqed.org/forum. And again, Oscar Villalon is managing editor of Zizava, the San Francisco-based literary journal, and they are celebrating their 35th anniversary next year. Barbara Lane is book columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle and director of events for Copperfield Books. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.